Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 168 of the Garden DC podcast. In this episode, we chat with Doug Oster, Pittsburgh's garden guru, about favorite fall perennials. The plant profile is on autumn daffodils, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events in the What's New segment. We close out with the last word on Flying Squirrels by Christy Page at the Food Gardening Network. This episode, we're joined by Doug Oster, Pittsburgh's garden guru, and a returning guest on the Garden DC podcast. Welcome back, Doug.
Great to be back, Kathy. You know, I always love talking to you. There never seems to be enough time. We get rolling and we just keep going.
I know. And there's so much more we can talk about in every category that we've covered in the past. We've had you for summer vegetables, about tomatoes in particular, our mutual love of Duke's mayo.
Yay!
That could be a whole episode right there.
I actually sent her a picture of from a prison documentary from 1966 where Duke's mayonnaise was on the table. So that's how deep this love of Duke's mayonnaise goes. Anything, I see anything about it, I sent it to her. Find that Duke's mayonnaise. I'm telling you, you won't be sorry.
Mm-hmm. And neither of us is sponsored by Duke's. I'm going to say yet.
Yes, yet. Right.
I definitely endorse any product that I use and enjoy, but obviously not a product that I would turn down. So today's episode, we are talking all about fall perennials and some of our favorites for the garden to continue that summer color into the fall and autumn season, in particulars with perennials versus shrubs and trees. But maybe we will kind of expand that category in some of our choices, Doug, and maybe cheat a little too.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah. So because we've had you on in the past, our listeners probably know a bit about you, but maybe I'll ask, since you were last on the podcast, any updates or fun things we should know?
Well, I host my own podcast called Talking Trees for the Davy Tree Expert Company. I have a radio show here in Pittsburgh, write for a local website, and just love to garden, love to help people garden. That's about it. That's all the new. But for me, and I was speaking today before we got together here to record, and people were saying, oh, it's time to slow down. Okay, the garden's done. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is the second most important season, fall. And, as you alluded to, trees and shrubs, and of course, for me, bulbs, but perennials in particular, it's a great time. I'm in zone six. And I'm finding at this time of the season, perennials are being marked down. And this is just, for me, the perfect time to plant them. And, I love perennials. They make my life a lot easier. I know gardeners go through kind of, just different moods for them. Like sometimes people will say, I'm going all perennials. And others will say, I'm going back to annuals because I want longer bloom time. But I grow plenty of annuals, but I love tough perennials that just do their thing. And any perennial that I'm going to recommend is going to be almost maintenance free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a love affair with perennials that kind of goes in and out of fashion, right? They were big in the 80s, big again in the early 2000s. And now it seems like shrubs are having more of their day. What do you think on that trend?
Yeah, and little shrubs. Again, when I was at this public garden, I saw a lot of little shrubs, especially when they're doing a lot of breeding with hydrangeas. And, for smaller yards, for urban spaces, even to grow in containers, yeah, that's definitely a trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. The dwarf size shrubs, they're compact, they're easy, they're almost like set it and forget it. Not quite as easy as bulbs, but, you know, close, because some of them will need pruning and maintenance down, but not the yearly whack back that, say, a perennial will.
Right.
So let's start with some of our favorite fall perennials. And on my list, I had at the top Japanese anemone.
Well, that's on my list too. I grow one called Queen Charlotte, and then I have another one. I don't remember what it is, but it's smaller and has a double kind of purplish flower. Not quite purple, but not quite pink. But Queen Charlotte is my favorite. You know, for a lot of people, Japanese anemone can be a bully, but I've gotten the spot where it's competing against bamboo, so it's fine. You know, my biggest mistake, I'm telling everybody that's listening, never plant bamboo. You know, this bamboo that somebody gave me said, oh, it doesn't spread, it's clumping. That was a lie, because I'll never get rid of it. So I've got that Queen Charlotte, which gets to about 4 feet tall, has beautiful deep pink flowers, and it just dances in the breeze. Yeah, sometimes a common name is windflower, but there's a lot of different windflowers. And, you know, that is one of those plants where you can just put in and it's going to spread for you. You know, cut out some pieces and give it to friends. And it's a late bloomer, which I just love. And it's not just a one-trick pony. The flower buds look great. The flowers look great. And then there's like kind of a white tufty seed head. So it's one of my favorites. The deer will nibble on it. It's not their favorite, but the deer will nibble on it. So I've got it out in deer country. So it needs to be sprayed with some repellent.
Yeah. And the foliage can look a little tattered or ratty if you got it like in full sun or full afternoon sun. So maybe morning sun is better for it. And if it gets a little dried out, like if we had a kind of dry September, so mine is looking a little brownish at the edges, but it still keeps on blooming up a storm. And the one I have is Robitissima, which is, you know, very bullish per the Latin name. It is definitely robust and a great spreader. The funny thing about it, Doug, is if you bring it to a plant swap, if you don't pot it up well in advance and let it recover for a couple weeks, you're basically bringing like what looks like wet spinach, you know. Like, it just does really resents being transplanted at first, looks awful, but will fully recover. All you need is a little section of the root.
That sounds awesome. And again, something you're going to have a lot of it, share it with friends and other people.
And if you have a good part shade situation, good filler for that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where mine is, part shade.
So what was next on your list, Doug?
Well, it doesn't have a common name. It's called Corydalis lutea, and it is one of my all-time favorites because of its long bloom time. So you could call this a spring perennial, a summer perennial, and a fall perennial. Sometimes people call it yellow bleeding heart, but that is really, it's not a bleeding heart, but it has beautiful kind of ferny light green foliage with yellow flowers. It gets to about 18 inches in the shade, about 3 feet tall in the sun. It'll grow anywhere. The deer aren't interested in it. It starts blooming in April, and it's still blooming now, and is going to go into at least November. And it makes this beautiful colony after just a few years from throwing seeds everywhere. If you don't want it where it pops up, you can just pull it out. Like, it's escaped into my vegetable garden. And when it starts creeping into the beds, I just pull it out, or I put it in a pot and give it to somebody. You know, it makes the garden look like someone's been gardening in it. And so when it's at its high point, because I'm all low maintenance, you know, for both of us, we're running around and speaking and, you know, writing blog posts and doing podcasts where we should be gardening. And I just love a plant that will spread on its own. It's great for containers. It's one of those perennials because of its long bloom time and toughness. It'll throw seeds into a container. It'll throw seeds into a crack. I just love the plant. And anybody that will listen, I will tell them about Corydalis lutea, just because of its ease of growth and its long bloom time. And I don't have to do a thing with it. And I just love that it's in the vegetable garden now because it's all around the edges of all the beds. And when it gets going out there, it's just, I guess it's not for everybody. It's not for somebody who wants a neat formal garden in mm-hmm. for my style of gardening, but it's just, I love it going everywhere. And as I said, if it's in a spot I don't like, I can just have no worries about just pulling it out because I got it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those that once you have it, it does recede everywhere. It acts almost like an annual, like you said, because it just keeps blooming and blooming versus a lot of perennials that just have like a 2-week bloom period. And then that's your basically all your season of interest.
Right.
But, you know, I have heard people warning about it, that it could be on the invasives list, but you know, everything is local. So check your local list, but you're right. It does lend color in a lot of spots. It comes up, you know, basically in the cracks of concrete. I mean, what could be easier than that?
Yeah. I hope it does not go into that like invasive category because it's so beautiful. I just love it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's displacing anything. So that's a little bit different than, you know, something that spreads readily, whether it is displacing a native plant.
Yeah, it's not underground runners either. It's just by throwing seeds here and there. And actually, I've never, you know, I've been growing it now for 22 or 3 years in my garden. There's no sign of it anywhere outside the garden. There's no sign of it in the forest. There's no sign of it at the neighbors. There's no sign of it anywhere else except for in my garden.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it is where you garden, like disturbed soil, mm-hmm. right? Versus like leaf litter in the forest. So that's a good thing for keeping it in check. So next on my list is the ugly named but beautiful plant, toad lily.
I'm glad you're going to talk about this one because I've struck out in growing it, and I've only tried a couple times, and I've put it in, I think the soil's too dry, but it's in with a bunch of ferns, and it's, you know, they're hay scented ferns, so they'll grow anywhere. They'll grow in dry woodland soil. And so I tried it there where I really don't take care of that area. I just let it go on its own. I was hoping it was going to be one of those plants that would take care of itself, but I didn't get it to come back. And I tried it a couple of years. So you give me the lowdown on this one, because I want to grow it because it's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do love Tricertis. I have several varieties of it. I think Samurai might be my favorite. It's got like a beautiful kind of chartreuse edge to the leaves. So even without those cute little orchid-like flowers, you get beautiful foliage. It does take a little more water than my dry shade. So where I plant it is around the base of my gazebo. And here's my laziness trick, Doug. When I'm watering the hanging pots that are hanging in my gazebo, that water spills down onto them below.
So I like that idea.
So there you go. That's the lazy watering trick. And so they're getting some supplemental water, not a ton, but some. But so I would say they don't like dry shade, but they're happily blooming in, you know, part to full shade. And this year, though, I've had another complication of a mom bunny and her 2 offspring moved under my gazebo, and they've been chomping on a couple of the varieties of Tricertis, and a couple they left alone. So I can't figure out why they like one and not another, but now I'm going to have to start spraying.
Yeah, that would be a case for me for spraying, you know, because it's not a food crop. You know, it depends on which food crop you're spraying. If you've got bunnies, I get bunnies that get into the veggie garden here and there until I can figure out where to get rid of them. There's something I use for the vegetables is called hot pepper wax. Mm-hmm. And for some reason we don't taste the hot pepper, but the animals won't touch it. And until I can figure out where they're coming in and out, I just use that. What are you going to do about your bunnies? Just going to live and let be, live and let live. Is that the right term? Live and let live. Yeah.
Live and let live. Yeah. I have been right now. I mean, when they're babies, they're so cute. You can't do much about them, but there are some, you know, juvenile hawks in the area. And so I haven't been discouraging the hawks. Let's just say that.
I had a family take up residence in my vegetable garden. And again, you know, a baby bunny, there's nothing cuter in the world. And so I actually raised them by just letting them do their thing in the fenced-in vegetable garden until they got to a certain size where my dog Max, when he was alive, could go in there and just chase them out, and then I'd be done with them. And so it's so funny that Max was getting up in years, and he goes in there, and actually I have a video of this, and you know, he can't even see the rabbit at this point. And then finally the rabbit moves and he sees the rabbit and he starts chasing it, and he's running out the garden gate. But before he ran out the garden gate, he never saw the rabbit just made a 90 degree turn behind the beehive. And Max came, you know, back into the garden with his chest all puffed up and, you know, saying, "I helped you out there, Dad. I got that rabbit out of the garden." So.
Well, they are clever little bunnies and they do blend in. I love how they think that you can't see them when they just freeze.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that might work with dog eyes, but that doesn't work with human eyes, mister.
I have a rabbit the size of a raccoon out there outside the garden. I think it's too big to get in. That's the other thing too, with the younger rabbits, the little baby rabbits, they can go in and out of chicken wire pretty easily, till they're a certain size, till almost they're mature. And so that's always an issue unless you've got fencing as tight as like something like hardware cloth. I've got just chicken wire around, you know, buried around a picket fence, you know, down there. And so far so good for the last couple of years, but something's in there munching on my Swiss chard, and it's not a rabbit because there's lots of other stuff for a rabbit. I think it's like a chipmunk or something. They, for some reason, they go after my beet greens and my, Swiss chard. So that's driving me nuts. I got to get some of that hot pepper wax on there, but there's only so many hours in the day, right, Kathy?
Yeah. And the hardware cloth is definitely the way to go. I found, that's the barrier I use around my lettuces and stuff at the community garden, because yeah, chicken wire is not going to do it for those baby bunnies. Yeah. Not at all. So let's go to the next one on your list. And I think you had hardy banana.
Yeah, this one's a star in my garden right now. And it's only about 3 seasons, maybe 4 seasons that I've had it. And I just started off with, you know, it was just a guy I did a story on, gave me a potted one, you know, maybe in a 1 gallon pot and maybe 18 inches tall. Now I've got like 6 or 7 banana trees out there. And again, I'm zone 5, 6, actually. I don't consider it 6, even though it technically is 6. I say 5, 6. And it's a, I don't know, 15, 18 foot trees, like 6 of them. And it looks so tropical. And I just love it. And all I have to do at the end of the season when frost gets to it is I just cut it off at the bottom. And it's easy to cut with just a simple pruning saw, even though it's, again, probably at least 12 inches around, probably bigger than that at the bottom. And then I just cover it with straw, and it comes back every year bigger and bigger. And then as it sprouts, I cut off the edges, the sides, and give it to gardening friends so they can have it. It's one of my favorites, especially this time of the year, as it's reached its maturity. And it's just huge. And it's growing in right across from those Japanese anemones. So not a lot of sun, you know. Mm-hmm. And I never water it. I never do anything with it. It just does its thing. It's never going to put bananas on it. That's not what it's for. It's just to give you this tropical look. And anybody that sees it, they're just like, "What? How?" Mm-hmm. I don't understand. And I'm like, yeah, this thing's hardy. And it is just a wonderful plant for the garden.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that's the Musa basju,
yes,
variety. And they're not technically, some people will call it banana tree, but it is a banana plant, not a tree.
To me, it looks like a tree.
It has a tree form.
You can call it whatever you want, but if you look at my garden, you're looking straight up and you're like, "Wow, that's a banana tree, baby."
Yep. It's just but we're considering it a very tall perennial for our purposes today. But yeah, definitely. And just dies all the way back to the ground, like you said, comes right back like a monster almost out of a Japanese monster movie. You're like, So next on my list is a huge category, and we could probably do the whole episode on this one easily, and that's asters. So we have our native asters, we have asters from Europe and Asia, and then we have all those great hybrids. What are some of your favorite asters, Doug?
You know, I have trouble growing asters because I don't have the sun that they think they would prefer. I love these tall native asters. Like, I was just at this, it's called the Pittsburgh Botanic Garden, and I do a quarterly thing there with the education director, and they just have all sorts of different asters there. And these, they have some real tall native ones. I have no idea what the name is, but one of the reasons asters are so important is they're such a great late source for pollen and nectar for our pollinators. You know, we're working so hard in like growing milkweeds and other things to help different pollinators, but this food source at the end of the season, that's what's so important. And like I said, I could probably get some asters to grow in the vegetable garden. That's where I get most of my sun. But my vegetable garden has become so filled with things that the deer eat. You know, the fenced-in vegetable garden is home to hydrangeas now, lilies, hostas, lilacs, and a host of other plants where I'm just running out of room. You know, I'm sure I could stick some asters in there. What about you? What are your favorites?
So I really like the white wood aster. And so that's one of our prolific natives. And that one, I think you have really good luck with, Doug, because that goes into the shade.
Actually, yeah. That's all over my forest. That's a native that's all over my forest. I love that one. I forgot all about that. Yeah, that one's blooming right now. And boy, that thing is tough as nails, and it's a real beauty.
Mm-hmm. It's drought tolerant. It's great. What I don't like is they changed the Latin. So now it's Eurebia. Yeah, Eurebia divaricata. So everything that was in that Asteraceae family kind of got split up in the last few years, and you have to learn all new Latin for those.
No, you don't. If you're like me, you just say, I don't know how to pronounce it, because I don't know how to pronounce it. You know, what is the other one? What is the aster that starts with S after it that they changed now?
Symphoconium, something like that. I'm saying it wrong, but it starts with symph.
Yeah, I'm not smart enough to know how to pronounce that. I'm just not, you know. Again, you know, the guy that I was with today is a PhD. And so it's good to play off each other. He said that name, you know, but when he said it, I said like Gesundheit afterwards because it was so long. It sounded like a sneeze.
Yeah, let's just stick with the aster. Yeah. That's probably the best one. And then, of course, the New England asters, the kind of like pale periwinkle color purples. I love that color in fall, Doug. Like people think of fall as those like blazing sunset tones,
right?
Orange, yellow, reds, and burgundies. But I really like the cool side of fall, those purple and dark, dark ones.
That sounds good, man. That sounds great. I'll have to throw something in the vegetable garden somewhere. But again, I got a whole bed in the vegetable garden that's turned into a nursery bed. And actually, that's where one of the Japanese anemones are. You know, people send you stuff and you want to grow it out. I got to get it out of that and then try something else in there. Oh, boy.
And I think asters in containers, that's a good idea too. So
maybe I'll try that. I like to use these fabric pots. They're called root pouches, and they're made out of recycled water bottles, and they're inexpensive. You can get a 15-gallon one from A.M. Leonard for like $5 or $6. And again, this isn't an ad. This is just what I use. And like I use those things a lot for like home and garden shows where I want to present, like, last year in the spring show, I had like 60 of them filled with veggies, and I gave them away at the end of the season or at the end of the show, where it has handles on either side so they can get them out of there easy. They're lightweight. You stack them together and they'll share water through a principle called wicking. That's a good idea for me. Now that gives me a good idea for asters to put them in something like that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing them more and more at garden centers where, you know, you have the tons of potted mums at supermarkets and things.
Yeah.
You know, I really think asters should be trained more and substitute for a lot of those mums, because the mums, you know, they're a little bit of pollinator benefit, like you were talking about before, but the asters are kind of off the charts as far as pollinator benefit.
And good luck making those mums overwinter, at least in this zone here. If you don't have them in by September and really give them water and a liquid fertilizer to try and help that root growth, forget it. I don't care if it's the hardiest variety, if it's something that's made to winter over, you know, it's 50-50 at best for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here in zone 7, I can usually get them to winter over by being lazy and waiting till like they've finished blooming, shearing them back, and then plopping them in the ground. But let's talk about some of the actual perennial mums, like the Sheffield Pink. Are you growing any of the Sheffield series, Doug?
No, I I'm trying to think the last one that I tried, I think it was a Glacier series, maybe. I'm not sure if that's the right one, but again, I tried that. I tried every trick I knew in the book to, you know, get them in early. Again, you know, water is important. I've been taught not to cut them back at the end of the season. That's supposed to help them, but I couldn't get it to overwinter.
Hmm. Yeah, I think drainage is the key I'm finding with the Sheffield Pinks. And also, mums are not long-lived plants. Like 2 or 3 years, and they kind of peter out, and you might want to divide them or grab a section or restock it, because a lot of them just are not, even though it's called perennial, right? You know, comes back every year, doesn't mean it lives forever. Everything has a lifespan.
I mean, I'm telling you, I have this friend, and he's not really that much of a gardener, but he was over in Ohio. He was zone 5. He had mums in there, and they acted like a long lived perennial, and mm-hmm. it was almost to the point of being invasive. They would just, they would spread like crazy for him, and they always came back, and you know. So it depends on your site too, and it depends on the luck of the draw too. And you know, his were in like full afternoon sun, as I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking it's the drainage, the good soil, like on a slope, good sandy soil is probably better than some heavy clay sitting in wet. So that reminds me also, when we're talking about short-lived perennials, of the whole family of salvias. And in particular, Mexican bush sage. So I usually can get a salvia to come back maybe 1 or 2 times, maybe a couple years, but then they peter out for me. How about for you, Doug?
Have you grown Maynite?
No, I haven't had that one.
That's a pretty good perennial one. Again, with the salvias, for me, it's about deer resistance. And I know we're talking about perennials, but I've got... You know, I'm just a big fan of Salvia Maynite. It's like 1999 perennial plant of the year. And I know that's a long time ago. And I know they've probably done breeding improvements and stuff. But that one, man, that's a tough one. And the reason I like it so much is, you know, like most plants, it wants to grow, flower, set seed, and go to sleep. On that Maynite, and probably others too, but I'm just most familiar with Maynite, it gets looking ratty with like trying to put on seeds, and you give it a good haircut and you give it water and you give it fertilizer. And when things cool off, it'll, if you're lucky enough, it'll put on a whole new flush of blooms. It'll take you all the way to hard freeze, not frost, but to hard freeze. And of all the ones I've ever grown, and I'm a salvia fanatic, mostly annuals because of their deer resistance, I'm able to grow salvias out unprotected. And I'm talking about, my herd is probably 22 now, and they walk right. I'm not kidding. I'm not joking. Ugh. And they have no fear. Seriously, the other day I saw $5 together. I've got, it's a Disney movie basically out there. I've got fawns and does and bucks, and they sleep in the garden, and they don't, you've got to get closer than maybe 20 feet for them to start running, and they don't run far. They just, you know, even hey, I've got a little dog on a leash barking like a wild hyena, and they're just like, what? I don't care. So when I get a plant like that, whether it's perennial or annual, I'm incorporating it in the garden. I love the blues and purples, but also on the annual side, the reds and you know, real bright blues. I love growing salvia for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, deer resistance is phenomenal. It is in the sage family, so it's got that kind of like aromatic leaf that keeps the deer away. And some people, for some, you know, like me, where it's almost a temporaneal, like a temporary annual, you could pot it up and bring it in, like in a protected spot, or treat it, you know, just as an annual. So depends. There's such a huge family of salvias to test out, and like black and blue, I've been having some luck with. One that I fell in love with called Purple Rain, for obvious reasons, because I'm a big Prince fan. That didn't even last a year for me, sadly. So, but keep experimenting, and there's a salvia for you.
I know we want to stay on perennials, but if we can talk salvia for just 1 second, anything from the like Wish series, Wendy's Wish, and then Amistad. Amistad is a real dark purple with, it looks like black and blue, only instead of blue flowers, it's a real dark purple. Like, again, I don't want to go too off the path of perennials, but again, as a salvia lover, those are just great plants for me, especially with so many people dealing with the deer.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you on Wendy's Wish. That is like such a great rebloomer in a container, and it just goes and goes and goes. So, and man, great annual salvia.
The hummingbirds love that one, and there's a whole series of them. I can't remember the other names, but there's one. I was at the Chelsea Flower Show, actually, and I don't know, it was 2 years ago, and they had a new one in that series. It was this brilliant pink. But I'd have to look back into my, I have a friend that works here at, there's our big public garden. The other one is called Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens. And I have a friend that works there, and we're both salvia nuts. And, you know, it was, I was at the Chelsea Flower Show, and I see this pink salvia. And so I send her a message, and it's, you know, it's 6 a.m. She's working like 6 to 2 there at the conservatory. And we're just texting back and forth like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Oh, look at this pink flower. I'll have to look it up and figure it out.
Yeah, I'm looking at a few of the sites that are, they're calling Wendy's Wish a 9-10 hardiness zone, just for the listeners out there to know. But it does last, you know, till a killing frost. And you know, it just keeps on blooming.
They used to label that one, believe it or not, when it first came out, it was labeled as a zone 7. So I don't know what changed, because I was figuring, like, you know, I remember the first year I saw it in the nursery, I was taken aback. It's so beautiful. And grew it out. And again, the hummingbirds loved it, and was hoping that I could pot it up, put it in an unheated greenhouse, and get it to winter over that way. And I still think I can, believe it or not. I think it's a pretty tough plant, but it had one of those winters where it was just like most of the stuff that I tried that I normally overwinter, like, you know, in the vegetable garden and that sort of thing, it, you know, most of it didn't make it because it was 2 weeks of like minus 10 or something, which is unusual here.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that might be worth trying that. Like I said, you know, dig up some of your salvia and try to get it as at least as a house plant in a sunny window for a while.
You have nothing to lose, but you have nothing to lose by trying that.
Let's talk about some of our hardier, tougher fall perennials that we don't even have to bother to pull it out of the ground. And I'm going to jump to goldenrod. So I know there's people out there saying, boo, hiss. They don't want to see another goldenrod. But what do you think, Doug?
Goldenrod is not a weed. It is a wildflower. And there are cultivated varieties. If you want, you have to tell people that you have a cultivated variety in there. I think is Fireworks one, Kathy, I think is one.
Yeah, that's one of the best.
I have all just native goldenrod growing everywhere, and it doesn't make you sneeze. The pollen's too heavy. It's another one of these great plants for pollinators at the end of the season. And turn your head around about this plant, and that's what I tell people a lot when they think something's a weed, like that, like this one. This is just an amazing plant. And just look, stop. The only reason it's a weed is somebody told you somewhere down the line that it's a weed. Just look at this plant. It's beautiful. And there's lots of weeds like that, you know. Okay, if they're invasive, forget it. We got to get rid of them. But this is just a completely positive plant. And again, today at the Pittsburgh Botanic Garden, you know, their hillside pollinator garden is just filled with goldenrod. And it's beautiful. If you think it's beautiful, and I certainly think it's beautiful, and it does so much for the pollinators, and you don't have to do anything to make it grow. It just does its thing, and that's what I want in the garden.
No extra watering, nothing, no maintenance. You know, you might whack it back if it's getting a little bit too tall and floppy. That's about it for some of the, depends on the variety. Like Fireworks stays shorter, more compact. And then there's some of the taller goldenrods and some of the more prolific reseeders. But guess what? Cut off the seed heads as the bloom is fading. But I don't do that, Doug. You know why? Goldfinches.
Yeah.
They go insane for this flower.
You know, another one, I don't have it on my list, but it just in that garden is reminding me, Joe Pieweed. And let me tell you, they had growing there, and I don't know the cultivar, I'm sorry, but they had one that was shorter with variegated foliage that we were just blown away by. And I saw it, and I was just like, oh my gosh, you know, they like mostly natives, you know, and this one wasn't in the pollinator garden because that's almost all native, but it was off in like a children's garden. And I asked the gardener, you know, what the variety was. They told me, but of course I can't remember. But just look up a variegated Joe Pieweed, and it was only about 3 feet tall. And again, they're taking a look at it, and they're making sure that it helps the pollinators. So they're trying it out for its beauty, but also they want it to work for the pollinators. And Joe Pieweed in general is just a great plant. You know, again, tough as nails. It's I know it has the name weed in it, but it's only, like I said, it's only a weed because someone told you it was a weed. I remember when Joe Pieweed started to become popular, it was because they were growing it like in these fancy gardens in Europe. And this is a long time ago, you know, 25 years ago. And then all of a sudden it became popular now in the States. Everybody wanted to grow Joe Pieweed. But, you know, now that breeders have worked on it, as long as the pollinator gets what it wants out of it, I'm fine with having something that's not, you know, a strict straight native. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, especially in a small garden, you know, 8 foot tall leaning over plant can be a little out of control. So those little Joes,
right,
you know, all those series of smaller ones, that's a great option for people. And so the other end of the spectrum are tall sedums. And it's funny, when we say tall sedum, we mean versus those that crawl along the ground, like the ground cover sedums and little succulents. But we're talking about like Sedum Autumn Joy and that series.
Yeah, you know, Autumn Joy is a great one. And again, I've got one growing in my garden. Again, a lot of times when people send you plants, I try to keep track of them, but it's in the heat of the battle. And it's hard enough just to get them into a container or into the ground for the time being, just so you don't kill it. And I know that sounds ridiculous. You know, if you're going out and you're buying plants and you're like, this guy's complaining because people are sending him plants. But I've got one. It's so beautiful. And it has the most beautiful pink flowers, but I have no idea what it's called. And I know that's probably frustrating for your listeners, but in my style of gardening, which has no style whatsoever, I try. I'm telling you, I really try to have that tag in there. I'm doing a little better, but again, in the heat of battle, you know, I'm going out of town here in 7 days, and I've got flats of lettuce. I've got a perennial hellebores to plant. I got so much to do, and I'm not complaining. I guess I am complaining, but don't hate me for complaining. You know, I'm trying my very, very best to keep this under control and get these plants in the ground without going crazy. And everybody gardens differently. And and so don't hate me for being an idiot, for being an idiot and not knowing the names of a lot of these plants. It's enough for me. Like, it's enough for me just to, I'm the only one that sees that plant. Maybe my wife might see it, but I'm the only one that sees it. And the fact that I get enjoyment out of it, that's great. I know it's part of my job to tell people, you know, this is a great variety. But sometimes it just doesn't work out that way. And I apologize for that, but I'm getting such immense joy out of this plant. I threw it in a container. It just does its thing. I mean, imagine just a plant, you just, you know, in the heat of the battle, you just, you're throwing this plant into a container and you say, okay, I'll get it into the ground eventually. It never did. And it's just doing its thing. You have this beautiful, you know, grayish green foliage all year. And then you get the gravy, you get these pink flowers right now. And mm-hmm. they're just amazing. Besides Autumn Joy, do you have some other tall ones that you love specifically?
Yeah, I love the new series that are like Thunderhead, and I think it's called Chocolate Cherry, where it's really dark burgundy foliage and kind of like, you know, a lighter color bloom. It could be anything from pink to burgundy in the bloom. And I've seen some with like the chartreuse green blooms with the dark foliage. That's a little out there for me. That's a little backwards looking.
That's right up my alley there. That's right up my alley. You know, that's the kind of ugliness that I need in my garden. And you might you might think they need full sun. They don't. This one is growing, 15 feet from the Japanese anemone and the banana plant. And it is in the vegetable garden. It gets a little bit more sun. But, you know, I'm in a woodland setting. It does not get full sun. It might get 6 hours, and it blooms like a champ.
Mm-hmm. I agree. My Autumn Joy and the related series are all part sun because trees have filled in. They were originally planted in the sun, but they still do well. The only caveat to that is the flop. So they might need a little bit of staking if you want them perfectly straight up and down. But I don't mind, you know, plants laying down or coming into the pathway a little bit.
I hope that next time that we see each other in Baltimore, if that happens, I hope I can see your garden this time. Last time I was in such a hurry, I had to get to Virginia to see my son. I wasn't able to see your garden. And I thought about that today, actually. I thought about how I wish I would have stayed an extra hour to see that garden, but I was running out of time. And
Yeah, I was going to say that will be for Mance next January, which the garden is not going to look like much in January should you stay to visit, but you are always welcome.
I know, but I'll see the bones. You know, I can see what you're doing, you know, mm-hmm. even in January. And your January is different than my January.
Mm-hmm. There'll hopefully be some color still there at that point.
I'm sure there will be.
And so those listeners who are curious, Mance is the Mid-Atlantic Nursery Trade Show that happens usually second week of January every year in Baltimore at the Convention Center. And that's a trade show for mainly East Coast to Midwest growers, wholesalers, retailers, and, you know, a fun place to get together for plant geeks.
Yeah, us plant geeks, you know, and for me, I get a lot of good interviews there. You know, like I need content for stories in the middle of winter. You got new stuff coming out, but also I need content for the radio show when people aren't calling with their garden questions in January and February. And so I get a lot of good stuff and just meet so many cool people, and you learn about plants, and it's actually really, I think in general, almost the only time that Kathy and I see each other. And we look forward to those days where we can hang out at Mance in the press room and then maybe get something to eat. And it's just, you know, it's fun.
And talk plants.
Yeah. Yep. We do a lot of plant talking. Yeah. When Kathy comes back from looking at all the plants, I sit down with her and I get my computer out and I'm like, okay, what did you see? What do I have to see? Because she finds all the good stuff all the time. You got to stop by this booth. You got to go to this booth. And so then I'm out on the floor looking around at all the stuff that Kathy tells me to go see. I have a couple things usually where I can send her to, but she sees it first.
That's my goal. So next on your list that I'm looking at here is a plant that I'm just planting, so I don't have experience with it yet, and that's the Aralia Sun King.
Oh, man, this thing. First off, super deer resistant. It actually gets to eventually be the size of a small shrub, and it's just grown for its chartreuse foliage. This time of the year, what happens is it starts to flower and it has kind of insignificant little round flowers. And when it does that, at least in my garden, because they have had one at this garden I saw today that was actually out in full sun, which I don't think is the right spot for it. I grow it in almost full shade. And it just brightens up any shady corner in the garden. And again, for me, the importance of it is I don't have to spray it. And mine's probably been there 3 or 4 years, and good 3 foot by 3 foot, maybe a little bit bigger. And again, this time of the year, nobody knows what Aralia is when they see it at the nursery. They're like, you know, when I happen to be at the nursery and if I see somebody looking at it, I'm like that, you know, the guy who buys the house and he's just like your parents. He's talking to people he shouldn't be talking to, but usually they're okay with it. I'm like, that Aralia Sun King is and especially here, deer resistant, shade lover. And it gets up size 3 by 3, 4 by 4. You should get that. Actually, last time I saw, there was a young couple leaving the nursery and the husband was first and he had the whole cart filled with this stuff. And I saw two or three Aralias in there and I stopped his wife on the way out. Oh, you guys made a great choice there. You know, that Aralia Sun King, and they, you know, didn't know who I was, but they were happy to hear that. Like, especially we are so, the deer are just killing gardening here. It's that out of control. You know, they're hunting them in the city with archers. You know, it's got to that point where people are giving up on gardening because of the deer. Now, I'm not going to lose. I'm not going to lose that battle. I'm not giving up on gardening because of deer. I'm figuring my way around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's fight the good fight. And, you know, we can live with some of that predation from deer. But, yeah, we definitely need to reduce those populations. And so let's go to the next one on your list, the Ligularia, I've heard is deer resistant. I don't know if it's deer proof. What's your experience been?
I never say deer proof, but if anything is going to be deer proof, and I call it Ligularia, I'm probably saying it wrong. You know, actually, I did a story on a woman that works at Ohio State, and her job was for all the website to do the pronunciation. And so I said, what are the right ways to say the plant name? She goes, there are no right ways. And so I need a t-shirt that says that, because I always say everything wrong. But Ligularia, where I have it, you know, Ligularia is known as a perennial for the shade that needs moisture. But where I have it, I've got it in the shade, but it's dry shade. I've never watered it. This one, the one that I'm talking about, is called Britt Marie Crawford. But there are many, many different cultivars of Ligularia. The Rocket is one that grows like 6 feet tall, and it starts blooming with yellow flowers at the bottom and works its way up. Britt Marie Crawford has this beautiful purple stems with like a bronze green foliage. This is more of a traditional perennial where you're really basically growing it for the foliage. And then, again, I use the term, and the gravy is these daisy-shaped, deep yellow, almost orange flowers at the end of summer, beginning of fall. And then some really cool looking seed heads. And I'm telling you, it is outside the fence. The deer walk right by it. Even the young deer, I've never had it touched. That doesn't mean anything. That, you know, a young deer could look at that and start nibbling on it. But for some reason, they do not touch it. And for some reason, this one, again, it doesn't seem to need the moisture that some of the other ones. And I'm just going by what I've heard, is that it likes a little bit of extra water. And again, there's lots of different Ligularias out there, and it's tough, but more of a traditional perennial with a short bloom time. But, you know, my son's just getting into gardening. He's got his second home, and he wonders why I want plants that only flower for a short time, whether it's a spring bulb or a Ligularia or what it might be. And I said, you know, he said, I want something that blooms from April until, and he probably says, till next April. And I'm like, we look forward to these ephemeral flowers where you wait for it. You know, when every day I walk in and out of that vegetable garden, because it's outside the vegetable garden on a little corner, and I see it sprouting early in the year, then I see it starting to bud, and I'm like, oh man, I can't wait. And one day you walk in there, I'm like, oh, there it is. And you get camera out and your phone, actually, and shoot it and post about it. And like, you know, you want to tell everybody about this plant because you've discovered something. And this was one that a breeder gave me 20 some years ago to try. You know, this is just coming out, he said, I want you to try it. And I'm so glad I did. It's just a true winner. And again, no maintenance, not low maintenance, no maintenance. And when I'm talking about that, though, real quickly, when I'm planting those, I'm digging a planting hole twice as big or maybe bigger than the root ball. I'm digging in lots of compost, and I'm planting that plant. I'm putting water on it right away, and I'm mulching right away, and that's it. That's all I want. That's it for the plants. You're on your own for the most part. And those are basically the plants that I want in the garden.
I totally agree on that. Super low maintenance. We're never going to call it no maintenance, right? But definitely super low maintenance. Just touch that plant once or twice a year at the most and just let it do its thing. And when you're talking about the short bloom periods of some perennials, like Ligularia, you get great seed heads, and those stay up for months at a time, and they're almost more beautiful than the flowers.
They'll be there basically almost all winter if you let them, and I let them. I like to leave everything up. I know that's not for everybody, but I find beauty in these dried seed pods in the winter. You know, for me, that's good winter interest.
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to do an episode one time about just about the seed pods in the garden, which are the best, and which are the most long-lasting, because some of them don't last as long, but all of them are usually pretty beautiful.
You know, as much as people hate Rosa Sharon, and I'm growing one that's sterile called Sugar Tip that I love. The PhD I was with today at the garden, he just put his finger in his mouth when I said Rosa Sharon. But those dried seed pods are, to me, really beautiful, and they feed the birds. You know, I know that's a pain for a standard Rosa Sharon that makes babies and people hate them, but believe it or not, I brought Rosa Sharon from my old garden because, you know, my kids are grown and gone now, but when they were little, they played basketball underneath that Rosa Sharon. You know how kids are. The ball goes into the tree, you know, they're running into the tree. Thing was tough as nails. I brought a few little babies from that one just because of those special memories. That to me is part of what gardening is. Even though I know the plant is, I don't care if it's anybody's favorite or if they hate it. Every time I look at that plant in the summer and it's blooming, I'm taken back to that time when my kids were, you know, 8, 9 years old. Now one's almost 40. And so to me, that plant is an important plant in the garden. It's not for everybody. But, you know, and, you know, I know I've left the perennial train again. I'm sorry. And I've gone into shrubs and trees. But,
yes,
you know, we got onto seed heads. So that's where I love to watch the birds on those Rosa Sharons, especially like the titmice like that. They'll just sit in there and they'll just dig through there. And it makes me feel good to see the birds feeding on those seeds.
And I think that does circle us back to that fall perennials. A lot of them that we are growing were pass along plants from gardens that we visited, from older relatives, or, you know, have special memories for us. I can say that especially for a Russian sage that I was given. And that's like a super tough, sun-loving fall perennial that just keeps on going and going, you know, borders on shrub, but it is a salvia. Any last perennial favorites that we haven't covered yet, Doug?
One more that I want people to know about, and it's called Helleborus niger. So you're probably familiar with the Hellebore orientalis that blooms with the crocus. This plant starts blooming in November, December, common name winter rose or Christmas rose. And it's evergreen. To have something blooming late like that, and if it's a normal winter and down where you're at, Kathy, this thing would be perfect. You know, I gave some to one of our friends that came to Mance, who lives down in Virginia. And because the way they're sold up here, this drives me nuts. You can't find them at the nursery. They're a holiday plant. They come out like a poinsettia or something. They expect you to put it on your windowsill and then throw it away or something at the end. And it's a perennial. It's this amazing perennial that blooms at November, December, January. I mean, what else could you ask for? It's evergreen. It has these deep green leaves. I'm somehow going to make it my job to get these plants into nurseries. I can do it. I have to get the time to do it and figure it out and promote it, because this plant is just amazing. Before I knew anything about gardening, and tell me if we're running out of time, Kathy, because I have just a little story about Helleborus niger.
No, go ahead and share.
I didn't know anything about gardening. And a friend of mine that worked at the newspaper that I worked at, she said, this friend of mine is giving away a plant. And I forget the name of it, what we thought it was. And I said, okay. And we went and dug these up. And I put it in like a 5-gallon bucket. It was like 90 degrees out. Stupid. And left it in the van, in her van, for like hours on end. And then got it back home, put it in this front bed at my old garden, and didn't think anything about it. I wish I could remember what it was, because it was supposed to be this shrub. And it took 3 years for it to come back, because I transplanted it so terribly. And by that time, I knew what a hellebore was. And when it started blooming in November, I was perplexed, because I was like, I thought these were supposed, this was pre-internet, I thought these were supposed to bloom like with the crocus. And so, you know, I went to the library and looked it up, found what it was. And I brought that plant, because I hate to be transplanted, I brought that plant from that garden 20 some years ago to this garden. And again, that's just, every time I see it bloom, I'm reminded of this long journey of learning to garden, of not knowing anything and really treating a plant badly. But yet now it's one of my favorites. I love it. And so what I do is I go to the nurseries. I even go to the box stores. I hate buying plants at box stores. Like, I never do it. But after the holiday, I happen to be walking through there. I needed something my hardware store doesn't, my local hardware store doesn't carry. And I saw racks and racks of Helleborus niger, 50% off. And they looked like they're about 3 days away from being thrown to the trash. And so I'll preface this by saying I'm super cheap and a trash picker. So I got the manager over, and he was very nice. And I said, how many of these do I have to buy to get like a really good deal? Because I know where these are going in 3 days. He goes, buy two of them at half price and just fill your cart up with everything else you want, because I want to get rid of them. And so then I got to figure out how to overwinter them, because I used to try and plant them in like January when we'd have a thaw. Then it gets too cold in February, it kills them. So now I have an unheated greenhouse, and I put them in there, and they love it in there for the winter. And I still have two flats of them sitting out in the garden right now that need to be planted before I leave town in 6 days. And I've given a bunch of them away to people. Again, down your way, man. They will thrive up here. They're tough as nails, but it's much easier to overwinter them where you're at. Yep. If I get any this year at the end, I'll have to bring them to Mance and let you in on the deals, so that you can take them back home and plant them in your garden.
Yeah. And I think I've had luck with a few that have been given to me as Christmas type gifts on the holiday timing. And you're right. You're taking a risk by planting them right away, but you know, on a January day when it hits 50, 60, it's tempting, and I've done it and I've had good success. So I'm zone 7. So again, not much to lose, you know. Yeah, I wasn't going to keep it inside as a house plant.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's what I actually talked to somebody today at that garden today that I'd given one to last April, and she planted it in May. And before that, I mean, I didn't give it to her in April. She planted it in April, but I gave it to her during the winter, and she did grow it that way. She grew it as a house plant. And I was wondering, I've been wondering if it could survive on the windowsill for people who don't have, you know, how many people have an unheated greenhouse or a cold frame or a spot like that, or some protected spot where it could overwinter. So I think you can do it on the windowsill. You have nothing to lose, especially when you buy it after the season. They're giving them away. You know, because I think they're pricey during the season. They're like in a little 6-inch pot, they're selling them up here for $25 to $30. Mm-hmm. You know, all in full bloom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, they push them into early bloom, you know, and get them full of vim and vigor. And then you just are supposed to enjoy them for the bloom and then throw them out, I guess, in your compost pile. But yeah, we cheapskate gardeners love to plant them.
I can't do it, Kathy. I can't do it. And I try and educate everybody I can on this plant to not do that. Because if you can get it established, you'll have this evergreen plant that when almost everything else is done, it's coming into its prime. I love that part. I just love that part of it. And believe it or not, in January here in zone 5-6, when you get a thaw, you'll see honeybees come to it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I definitely have seen bees, and even some of the early, you know, native bees that break dormancy or come out early, visiting them. And the later hellebores as well, of course. So, Doug, wrapping up our fall perennials chat, how can our listeners follow up to find out more, find where you're at, and talk to you more about fall perennials?
Everything I'm doing is at DougOster.com. It's DougOster. And if you have a garden question, that's part of my job. I answer garden questions all day long. Just send a message through and I'd be happy to talk to you about whatever your problem is, or maybe even if you have some advice on something cool to do. I love the interactive nature of what we do, Kathy, of being able to talk back and forth with gardeners. You know, real quick, sorry, I know you're ready to shut me up, but I love that part of it, to be able to talk back and forth with people. And in a internet world where people are always like worried about trolls and this and that and bad things, I never get that out of gardeners. It's always positive stuff, back and forth, trying to help each other. I always say that fishermen have secrets, but gardeners don't have any. They love to share everything.
Well, thank you for sharing, and thank you for being on the Garden DC podcast again, Doug.
Thank you so much for having me. That was fun.
Sternbergia plant profile. Autumn daffodils, Sternbergia lutea, is also known as the winter daffodil, fall daffodil, lily of the field, or yellow autumn crocus. It is actually not a daffodil or crocus at all, but is in the amaryllis family. It is native to southern Europe. This charming fall blooming bulb is an old-fashioned favorite that deserves a spot in your garden. It is drought tolerant, virtually pest free, and deer plus rabbit resistant. The autumn daffodil grows to about 6 to 8 inches high and has thin, strappy foliage that emerges in late summer, then the bloom appears in mid to late September. It is hardy to USDA zones 6 to 9 and does best planted in full sun to part shade in well draining soils. If your soil is acidic, you might add lime to make it more alkaline and these bulbs happier. Autumn daffodil is an heirloom pass-along plant that will naturalize and form a small grouping. You can dig and divide the bulbs to share them with others or plant them around your garden. Sternbergia, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, it was a delight to be sitting in my gazebo and watch the hummingbirds visit my canna flowers. Even this late in the season, they still need that nutrition. Over at the community garden plot, we dug up our sweet potato vines only to find, nothing. So some creature had gotten in there and already eaten the tubers. So we'll try again next year. In local gardening events, you might want to attend the Spooky Arboretum Night Hike at the Blandy Arboretum on Friday, October 13th from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. And you can find out all about bugs, bats, and things that go bump in the night as you explore the Arboretum in Boyce, Virginia. So you can sign up for that at their website. Members and UVA alumni are $10 fee, non-members are $15. There's also family rates. Another walking tour you might want to attend that same weekend is at the Arlington National Cemetery. They're having their Memorial Arboretum walking tour on Friday, October 13th from 9 to 11 a.m., led by Greg Hughes, an ANC forester. You can come see the trees of Arlington at the peak of their autumn splendor. There's over 300 species of trees at the Arlington National Cemetery for you to see. You can also visit again on Friday, October 20th at 9 a.m. for a What's New at the Memorial Arboretum Walk with horticulturist Kelly Wilson. And there are several other fall color and walking tours happening at the Arlington National Cemetery this fall. Just go to their website and you can find out details on that. And then finally, the White House is open again for their annual fall garden tours. You can find out more about them at whitehouse.gov. That is Saturday, October 14th and Sunday, October 15th from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It is free, but the tour requires time tickets that you can pick up from the National Park Service outside the White House Visitor Center on Pennsylvania Avenue, starting at 8:30 a.m. each day. Then you line up for your entry point near the South Lawn. And I can say the tour is well worth it. You can see a little short we made about the tour on our YouTube channel for Washington Gardener Magazine. And that was a lot of fun and a perfect weather day. I hope if you go, you have the same wonderful time and perfect weather as well. Happy gardening!
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jensen Terry Spade, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in the urban garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at amazon.com or bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal, the perfect lawn, is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
This is The Last Word on Flying Squirrels by Christy Page at Green Prints. I'm not a person who uses the word hate very often. It's just not a frequent part of my vocabulary, but I will say that I hate flying squirrels. It has not always been this way. For years, I was actually quite ambivalent. I never even gave them much thought. That all changed a few years ago and became a struggle I will never forget. The first incident that spurred my hatred of flying squirrels was not even a direct contact. I was away on a trip and woke up one morning to a video text from my daughter. In it, there was a lot of yelling, running around, and general mayhem. I had no idea what was happening, but called home to find out. Apparently, the prior evening, just before midnight, when everyone was tucked safely in bed, we had an intruder. The four-legged kind. Yep, a flying squirrel. The dogs went crazy. My daughter was startled. It was in her room. And my husband struggled to capture it and get it out of the house. I thought it was going to stop there. Just an amusing story that we could look back on and laugh about after they caught up on sleep and straightened up the house. Well, a few weeks later, I found a couple of acorns in a drawer. I still didn't put two and two together. It wasn't a drawer I used very often. I had no idea how long they could have been in there. And a few weeks after that, we heard a few scampering footsteps. It sounded too loud to be mice, but we put out a couple of traps just in case. After 2 weeks, we had bear mouse traps and more scurrying noises. I talked to a couple of pest companies, and they said that our best bet was to trap them and release them. We bought a couple of humane traps, did a lot of research, experimented with the best type of bait, and did a lot of waiting. We then started catching flying squirrels. Not one, not two, but over a dozen. It was a long, crazy winter. Spring came and we didn't hear any more noises. We were hopeful that all was solved. We spent the summer happily reveling in the fact that we didn't hear anything in the attic crawl space of our house. We were lulled into a false feeling of security. Fall came around again, and so did the scurrying noises. Out came our trusted traps and long nights of catching flying squirrels. An animal that I had honestly never given much thought to became an obsession. I was researching this rodent as if I were about to give a dissertation on it. After several more weeks of this, we decided it was time to turn it over to the professionals. They came and built eviction ports in the eaves of our house and plugged up every little small hole they could find. Apparently, a flying squirrel can fit through an opening the size of an average pinky finger. For the next few weeks, we heard less and less noise until the blissful night when there was none. We elatedly called the pest expert, who told us to give it a couple more weeks. 2 weeks went by of quiet nights and deep sleep. It seemed like the eviction process was a success. The pest company came back and removed the eviction ports and closed those holes up as well. I don't know when I have been happier to see an animal go. The flying squirrels didn't damage anything. They didn't eat any crops, but they did tamper with our sleep and sanity. So while I'm not a person who uses the word hate often, I will say that I hate flying squirrels, and I think with apt reason at this point. I will now wait with bated breath for the first few chill fall nights and see if I'm awoken by any scurrying noises. If I am, I know to just leave it to the professionals. This was the last word on flying squirrels with Christy Page at greenprints.com.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.